Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM. Good Lord, messed up already. What a day. CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I cannot fix that in post, but whatever. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
I'm Candace LePage.
All right.
I got that one right. Yes!
Nailed it.
Perfect.
Right off the bat. Stay the course. Stay the course. All right, let's get into it. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the news movies, which this week will be a film about a beloved children's toy that is owned by a boy named Andy, and it comes to life, and by that I mean the remake of Child's Play. I deked a little.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including the future of movies. The New York Times asked some of the sharpest minds in the business about what the future will look like. So what will it look like? And then we'll look at the summer of vaguely unsatisfied sequels. Once again, the summer of sequels has failed to impress, but is that likely to change? And then finally, we haven't seen or we haven't had a good movie about Napoleon made. And a Reddit thread asked the question, why has that been the case? And we will ask that question too and try to answer it. But first... I feel like it's been a while since we had a good Me Too fatality.
Yeah, it has been a little bit quiet, which, you know, you would think was maybe because men were adjusting their behavior, but maybe that's not why.
No. Well, I mean, it's certainly in the case of Max Landis, in case listeners missed it. Max Landis, who is well-known as a son of... well-known Hollywood director John Landis, who made National Lampoon's Animal House, American Werewolf in Paris, and a lot of other...
One part of the Twilight Zone movie.
The most
just
infamous,
to bring in the scandal.
The most infamous part of the Twilight Zone movie.
That Landis name.
It's cool. I mean, yeah. Max Landis is the screenwriter of Chronicle. I was going to say Young Frankenstein, but it wasn't Young Frankenstein. It was Victor Frankenstein.
Oh.
And Bright, as well as some other films. But, I mean, it's been kind of undercover. Well, maybe not so undercover, but sort of in the whisper gallery, shall we say, for a while. He's been one of these awful people in the business. And their Daily Beast posted a full-blown expose with quotes from 8 of his former girlfriends alleging abuse, harassment, sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And I think indications that he was basically running a cult of people.
Yeah, yeah. So some of this bubbled up about 5 years ago, I'd say, probably prior to the era of Me Too, which we'll say Harvey Weinstein sort of is the first person to be.
He was the Fort Sumter of Me Too.
Yes, yeah. But that's not to say that people weren't doing untoward things before that. So I definitely remember Max Landis's name being bandied around as being kind of a jerk. I knew him... certainly as the son of John Landis, but more importantly, I knew him as the guy who did the video about the Death of Superman comic book, where he did this sort of great breakdown of the Death of Superman comic, which is widely regarded to be sort of dumb because he just came back.
Right.
So, I remember Max Landis from that because it was this sort of hilarious thing. And then you started bubbling around that... you know, he was basically one of those, I don't want to say typical because I don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, but the stereotypical geek boy who was always picked on and gets a little bit of like power and fame and just is not very nice to people in general. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't surprised at all to see his name involved in this Me Too thing. I'm like, oh, didn't we kind of already know this?
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's similar to the Bryan Singer thing where I think that was also a Daily Beast expose.
Yeah.
Where...
it was the Atlantic, actually.
Yes, it was the Atlantic. You're right. Where it gathered, like, everything in one place, like, all the... Plus a lot of new information as well. Yeah. And it seems to be that, you know, you sort of need that
it's the cumulative
effect. Right.
Because that's the thing. Like, not that only one time... is okay, but it's, you know, one time can be an error in judgment or something that was just with that particular person. Like when you look at Chris Hardwick and his relationship with Chloe Dykstra.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had a very antagonistic relationship. So while I certainly believe that there were things that happened within that that were terrible, that wasn't a pattern of behavior for him. It was two people really bad for each other.
And similar with NC's Ansari. Then,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and that doesn't, I mean, it doesn't sort of wash away that problem.
No.
But when you get a person who just consistently has a pattern of behavior, yeah, it becomes an issue. The thing I think is interesting about this, and I think that I haven't really heard it likened, but I was reading this article, and I was just like, boy, I'm kind of reading about Vince from Entourage, aren't I? Like that, I mean, I think this is what has happened, right?
Right.
Because you look at that. It was a boys club. It was, I'm famous. I'm bringing all my boys with me. We're all cool. You want to be part of this. And we're not going to be very nice to other people. There were certainly some behaviors that were not great in that show. And we put them on a pedestal.
And it even turned, like, by the time the Entourage movie came out, people were like, ew, this is gross.
Yeah.
And I think that was even before Me Too as well. But that's a good point, except I think Max Landis took it a bit too far. Not that any of this wasn't too far.
I mean, he's no Rainier.
No, that's right. But, you know, there was allegations in the article that he would, like, pit people in the group against other people in the group. And, you know, I don't think, you know, Vince was pitting drama against, you know, one of the other two. And I don't
Not on purpose.
Not, I mean, well, I don't remember,
like,
that.
I feel like drama was pitting people against
right.
each other on purpose.
Exactly. hence the name. But it seemed like there was an element of, like, sociopathy to this. Like, I have control over you
people.
And, like, I'm going to invite you to this party or this cool thing, like Idlewild. Mm-hmm. Or meanwhile, you guys are going to not go with this one. Yeah. And, like attack each other.
I'm just going to, like, drop a name of a person I have a lot of respect for, but it's highly problematic.
Mm.
Joss Whedon.
Mm-hmm.
Right? These are people who are the traditional sort of geek from the 80s when that was not cool.
Right.
And that was something that you were made fun of. And suddenly a lot of these people
are the coolest people ever. Tell me again how being a geek is not cool in the 80s. Anyway.
What would you know about that? And it's funny because I recently watched Jump Street, 21 Jump Street, which is, I'm like, I don't know, what is that, 5 years behind the times? But I watched it
the
one night.
That's Tatum and Hill?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was 2012. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
And
still holds up.
I mean, you see it happen right there, right? Where it's like the geeky guy who is always being made fun of is suddenly, like, they go back to high school and everyone's like, yeah, you're the cool one.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where we live now, which is fine and it's great. But the problem is there's this sort of in-between generation of people who are like, that was not cool when I was struggling through it.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm on top, you know, bullying behavior doesn't have anything to do with the like what you actually like. It has to do with the amount of power you feel you have.
Right.
And how much you feel you need to feel good about yourself.
And one of the things I would note, too, is that Joss Whedon, his father was a famous TV writer.
Mm-hmm.
Max Landis, of course, his father is famous for escaping manslaughter charges and other things.
But also for making some fine movies. I mean, American Werewolf in London, come on.
Sure, absolutely.
It's a difficult...
Blues Brothers, yeah.
Difficult place to be when you are sort of an outcast who suddenly has a lot of power. And a lot of these people make really bad choices with it.
Yeah, and it seems like it went back a while because Josh Trank piped up and said that he had to bar Max Landis from the set of Chronicle, which I found interesting given some of the stuff about Josh Trank.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, that guy's not very well.
Shooting Fantastic Four, and it's like, if Josh Trank thought you were too much, you know, it's, you know, you should reevaluate yourself. I do feel like Max Landis is also the one who sort of coined the controversy about Rey and Star Wars being a Mary Sue because she was, like, overly competent. So,
God,
like,
heaven
he's had
forbid
women
a woman is able to do something. I mean, I just sit around all day eating bonbons.
Well, I mean, to go back to your point about the bullying, it wasn't just the bullying. There was clearly a pattern of, like, girls, no. Yeah. I'm better than women. And, you know, that goes straight into, I mean, if you see a lot of this stuff, like Chronicles, an all guys movie, and Bright, I think there's like one really prominent female character in Bright. Victor Frankenstein, you know, James McAvoy, and Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter, in that. You know, it's just it's funny when you sort of see these things lined up. It's a pattern, and it's clearly, you know, someone who should really check themselves before they.
And it's going to take longer than 6 months to fix that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and this is it, too. And the people who've tried to make the comeback, like Louis C.K., shows, like, sort of no signs that he's kind of learned anything. In fact, what he's learned is, like, I'm going to double down, like, with his Parkland jokes.
Yeah.
So it's
awful.
Yeah. Pretty awful. Depending on your point of view, it's going to be pretty awful for the movies in 10 years. The New York Times put together this article where they got together people like the Russo brothers, the directors of the Avengers movies, J.J. Abrams, who I think we all know, Kamal Nanjiani, John M. Chu, Jason Blum, and talked about like what the future of movies will look like. And I don't know if we got anything substantial out of it, but I think what it says is that no one really has a right answer or an answer.
I mean, I really enjoyed reading it. I liked the way that it was set up, and I liked the variety of people they had interviewed for this. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it does show that you know, nobody really knows what the future holds. Also, nobody really knows what should happen or can agree to what they like. Mm-hmm. I am not particularly worried about the future of movies in sort of the larger terms. Because I see movies as part of an entire system of entertainment. Humans need to be entertained somehow, and half of the humans need to create things somehow. So we have talked about all these major studios that are becoming bigger and bigger, and we're going to talk about it probably next about how they just keep making huger movies with bigger budgets and people aren't coming to them. And that is a problem, but I think that it's a problem that needs to sort of get to somewhere where it implodes, and then suddenly we just have this like rising phoenix of all these independent sort of artists who are making really interesting films that cost less money, and actors are like, I really want to do this. This sounds like such an interesting project. I mean, we see it happen every, you know, 30 or 40 years or so.
Right.
And then not only that, now we have access to so many different types of storytelling. You know, for a while, it really was, there was TV and movies and maybe like Broadway plays. Right, like a live theater experience. That was sort of it for storytelling. Like, radio plays had gone by the wayside. Radio was basically just like Top 40.
Well, in North America.
Yeah.
BBC and, you know, still does radio plays.
But, you know, for storytelling, that was sort of it. And then read a book. And now, you know, we've got this just amazing plethora of ways in which stories can be told. And we can consume stories. And you see actors, for instance, or writers or whatever, like trying out the different mediums. So moving from movie to TV, right, there's has been the golden age of TV where these amazing movie stars are like, wow, TV is actually the place where I get to really dig in and do interesting work, which is maybe what they used to think about when they would go do a play for a bit. They're like, oh, this is really interesting. Now they're doing that on TV. And then we have, you know, like I said, like web series, short form stuff, these, I mean, even interactive kind of films.
Yeah.
So I think the future of movies, if all we're talking about is a roughly three-act structure that is, you know, 90 to 120 minutes and, you know, released first on a big screen and then released in the home, sure, that, you know, if you want to talk about that, there is certainly a question mark there.
Yeah.
But if we just want to talk about people being able to create and tell stories in interesting ways and humans wanting to purchase those or watch those in some ways, I don't think that there's anything to worry about.
Right. I think there's numerous concerns. I think there's one of them was mentioned by Anthony Russo, who said, like, there used to only be so many things, and now there's, like, so much. There's, you know, there are more movies than ever are released in the theater, actually,
given
the fact that you have, you know, the bigger studios downsizing the number of movies they make. You actually have more stuff coming out because you have these new players like A24 and E1 and Summit and all that. And then on TV, you know, everybody's getting into the TV business. There's like 700 different scripted shows. That's before you get into reality shows. And that's before you get into things like 60 Minutes and that old
or
people
like
me watch, or
or miniseries
or you know, things like Live PD, where it's like 5 hours of watching police raids on A&E.
It's a thing.
It's a thing. It's a thing.
But there's just
so much. And I think the struggle will be, you know, can you adapt? I guess, is there something, is there like a type of thing that suits streaming? Is there a type of thing that suits TV? Is there a type of thing that suits movies? And do we kind of get more universality there? Do we just go to the movies for the big, big spectacle things? And then, like,
spoiler alert, I think the answer to that is no.
Well, I mean, but it's a question, right? And
what
Paul Feig, director Paul Feig of like Ghostbusters and Bridesmaid fame, you know, pointed out that, you know, you can't really get the same out of Lawrence of Arabia watching it on your phone, because he pointed to the scene where he comes up over the sand dune on a camel, and it's this little dot on the middle of the vast screen, and you lose all that the smaller the screen.
I mean,
gets.
Some people might argue you can't even get the, you know, full thing of that if you're not watching like a 70 millimeter print.
for sure. I mean, there are people who go that far too. Another thing that I read this week was a Vox article where they were talking about how people just are kind of default going to TV now, and she was making the broader point that a lot of TV is like spread out, so that you have to make 10 to 13 episodes when like maybe 5 or 7 would do. But she was also making the point that things like the Chernobyl miniseries, or the Fosse-Verdon series. Those are the kind of things that they would make movies of, like 10 years ago, and like do it like 2.5, get like Oscar winners and like market them and push them in a way that would try to get them Oscar consideration.
Yeah.
And now like all those kind of ideas are going to TV because you have more freedom, you have more time, you can attract those actors because they're looking for those kind of cool dramatic projects.
And in some ways, particularly with the Fosse and Verdon thing, I feel like it is actually creating appointment television again.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know if you were on Twitter that night, but I was, and I was like, what is going on right now? And I had to look it up because like my Twitter stream was just filled with people watching it and talking about it live, which to me was just really neat to see. You know, and it's sort of, you know, even thinking about the recent NBA basketball.
Yeah.
And I sort of think, you know, I was walking home from downtown on the night of the last game, and I could hear, like, you know, in the condo buildings and in, like, open windows, I could hear the game in people's houses. I'm like, you know, people talk about MASH being, like, the biggest viewership ever, and no numbers will ever match that again. I'm like, I don't know if anyone's counting this basket. Cause, like,
right. Certainly not for series television,
no.
But sporting events is where the,
but
you find
I
those numbers
think
now.
Because, you know, we are actually, we've sort of come around again now. I feel like there are a lot more people, and in some ways the immediacy of social media is part of it.
Right.
It's created this FOMO, right? This, like, oh, this is going to be on. Everyone's going to be watching it. I want to take part in the action. And this is part of what they did talk about in the article. That's the word I'm looking for. About how, you know, people want to, this is the interactiveness too, right? People want to interact with what they're watching a lot more now on a second screen. And you just can't do that in the movie theater.
No.
Thank goodness, because I don't want people doing that. But I do think it's totally acceptable. You know, and you could even maybe create a movie theater experience like that. Like there are theaters that will do like second run, and it's like a cult showing of something, and they want audience participation.
Right.
You could sort of create a theater experience around that as well, so that people are, you know, interacting on their second screen at the same time.
I don't know if somebody was doing this a couple of weeks ago when I was watching Godzilla, but they were sitting in the front row. I was sitting in the back. I'm trying to watch Godzilla, and he's taking out his phone every 5 minutes, and I'm in the back yelling down at the front, turn off your phone. And I don't think he thought I was talking to him, but like during the climax, he whips out his phone again, and I finally yelled on, you in the front row, turn off your effing phone. Except I didn't say effing, and he didn't turn on the phone again as the movie was on. So you know what? If you're in a theater and you hear someone yelling, turn off your phone.
They're talking to you.
And you have your phone out. They could be talking to you. But that's just a roundabout way of queuing up the next conversation, which will involve Godzilla. But I think most studio analysts will agree. It's been a cruel summer so far. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. So, I think that cues things up nicely, because it has been a cruel summer for some of these sequels that we keep getting inundated with week after week. They say we want them, but apparently we really don't. So, this was written about in Forbes and a couple other places, but we're going to refer specifically to the Forbes article. That pointed out that you had this summer so far, you've had Godzilla King of the Monsters that has made less money than the original Godzilla, not the original Godzilla, but the Godzilla reboot that was released in 2014, for which Godzilla King of the Monsters is a direct sequel. Secret Life of Pets 2 opened at approximately less than half as much money as Secret Life of Pets in 2016. You had Men in Black International bomb. You had Dark Phoenix, basically bomb.
Basically. I think it's the definition of a bomb.
Yeah. So, you know, it's... I feel like this is a story that we get every summer. That you know, we get a ton of sequels that have a lot of high expectations. And people, even, you know, cynical people, you know, covering movies will say, you know what, maybe it'll be pretty good. And it turns out it's not good. Or it's... something like Booksmart, which kind of gets smothered by all these big movies, and it's a classic problem we get every summer at the box office there.
Well, I feel like I'm always surprised by what movies are getting sequels. I'm like, did anybody ask for a new Men in Black film?
Sony did.
but why?
They thought it would make money, I guess.
Did they see the results of the Independence Day sequel? Because the thing is that they
also notably didn't have Will Smith.
Exactly. That's exactly my point, right? What you had was a franchise with a star, mm-hmm. Will Smith, mm-hmm. and he is not attached to it any longer. And it turns out that really was the vehicle that made this movie a success. I think, you know... people can say whatever they want about Will Smith, but he is very charismatic and brings a lot of people to the theater. I mean, Aladdin. Mm-hmm. People really liked going to see Aladdin.
Mm-hmm. I think Will Smith's a big part of that because yeah. I think it sort of reminded people of the good old Will Smith.
Yeah.
And I think that that was to its benefit. I will admit to being surprised that Aladdin was as big as it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a surprise, not surprise, but it goes to show you maybe how much faith we put in pre-release Twitter buzz and
yeah.
things. But, you know, it plays exactly like the original 92 Aladdin, just with live action people.
Yeah.
And I think I noted this in our review. It's like, if you've seen the 92 Aladdin, you've seen this one, but it's still in the top five.
Yeah.
About a month
later.
Well,
and I feel like, you know, sort of Beauty and the Beast versus Aladdin, I feel like the story of Aladdin, even as a live action, will still appeal to more kids. Whereas the story of Beauty and the Beast as a live action versus as a cartoon,
mm-hmm.
I don't feel like that's going to appeal to you know, 6 and 7 year olds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, do you want to see a story of two people falling in love?
But I mean, that's where the dancing dishes come into play.
And were they dancing dishes in the
yes.
live action? See, I don't know, because I didn't watch it, because I actually have no interest in watching a live action.
It's interesting you should say that, though, because I think that was the biggest movie domestically
mm-hmm.
of, I think it was 2017. I think that was the highest grossing movie domestically that year. And what you have interesting is like, well, who are these being made for? Well, Godzilla King of the Monsters is actually in the top 10 when you consider worldwide box office.
Mm-hmm.
It's number 10. Above that is Dumbo. Did you hear anybody talk about Dumbo?
Oh my God, no.
But Dumbo is the number 9th biggest moneymaker worldwide of 2019 so far.
It was basically a blink and you'll miss it in the theater here. Like I couldn't even remember when it came out.
March, the end of March.
Really?
Yeah.
I remember seeing ads for it, and I remember us talking about how much I was not interested in seeing it.
Yes, I remember that. But it's you know, I think that's the side of this that doesn't get covered, is that, you know, yeah, in North America, we don't care about Dumbo or, mm-hmm. or Godzilla or what have you. Overseas, though, they're eating it up. I mean, I cared about, I liked that Godzilla, but, you know.
I haven't had a chance to see it.
I mean, en masse.
But it's true. You're right. Because the, you know, and we sort of talked about this a little bit before in the future of movies, right? The reality is that we do live in a capitalist society, and these studios need to make money. So, yeah, I mean, if they're making money, they're going to be happy, presumably. I mean, and we can all argue that the reason they continue to cast white people in what should be Asian roles is
right
because they want it to play well in an Asian market, and they keep telling us that they want to see white people, they want an American movie there.
I do wonder what that is. And you know, maybe something like The Secret Life of Pets 2 gets, you know, dubbed or something with, you know, relevant people. So you look at the little dogs and cats, and they're speaking Mandarin or Farsi or whatever.
Yeah. The other thing is Dark Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd like to go see it just out of interest. I think that the first of the new X-Men sort of films was very well done. It was interesting. But why? Why would you even want to go down the path of making a Dark Phoenix movie? We know how difficult this movie is, this story is to tell. We know how terribly the first movies did it. We also know how beloved this particular storyline is.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you are doing like an Avengers style, like Marvel, like 19 movies are aiming to Dark Phoenix.
Right.
Don't tell that story.
I think that's where it falls flat.
Yeah.
I think, and of course there's stories about behind the scenes things about rewriting basically the last half of the movie. It was supposed to be two movies at one point, apparently, and then, you know, the Fox Disney merger thing happened, and it has all the fingerprints on it of people who were just kind of wanted it done and finished and move on, like it was too far into it to not complete it kind of deal. And we'll see what happens with that last, what's technically supposed to be the last X-Men movie, New Mutants. Which has,
oh, see, I sort of thought Dark Phoenix was the last movie, but yeah, that's right.
There's in the can or in some form. But to wrap this up with Men in Black International, the THR had an article that was just basically that it was, there was this push-pull between what F. Gary Gray wanted to do, who's the director, and what Walter Parks, who's been the long-term producer of the franchise, long-term associate of Steven Spielberg, who is also the executive producer still. And there's sort of like a yin yang. You know, Parks had final cut. Gray was shuffled off, and Gray wanted to quit apparently several times and was talked out of it. And eventually, you know, the studio seemed actually disinterested in what happened. They just wanted it out there, and you know, you see the result of that. And I don't know how much Men in Black did internationally. But maybe it's just a matter of the fact that I think the budget was $110 million. They split it with like Chinese funders. So at the end of the day, they've cushioned their loss. If it was a success, great. If it was not a success, well, we didn't spend a lot of money on it. And you know, unfortunately, you know, the IP and the recognition sort of makes it a gamble they're willing to take. Anyway, we'll leave that there. Let's talk about a movie that apparently no one wants to make.
And rightly so.
The ultimate Napoleon biopic. And this was on Twitter. Somebody posted in the movie subreddit on Twitter, where is that Napoleon Bonaparte biopic?
Uh-huh.
And I am curious about this because we've had biopics of like quasi terrible people.
Mm-hmm.
Like one even won an Academy Award. Mongol, which was a biopic about Genghis Khan, won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film back
in
2007.
So, I mean, basically we're just going to go through the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure like elevator of people, right? We've got Lincoln already.
Right.
We certainly got Billy the Kid. We've done Joan of Arc. We've got Genghis Khan.
Yes.
Beethoven.
Yeah.
Beethoven. And Socrates.
Right.
And then
I don't know. Has there been a good Socrates movie?
I don't think there has been a Socrates movie. Socrates, Napoleon.
Who has the rights for the Republic?
What? Let me tell you, I have not even read it. I own it and it's on there, you know, so I look good. But I've never read it.
Your bookcase passes muster until people start looking at the spines for cracks.
Yeah.
I hear you. That's why I buy used. Kidding. Moving on.
But really, Napoleon.
Napoleon, yeah. I mean, this was, of course, Stanley Kubrick's White Whale, where he was trying for years to, and you know, apparently he did all this research. He had boxes and boxes of research.
Talk about a bully of a man.
Well, that's true, too.
It's probably why he was so invested in Napoleon. It's I see something in this man that
could be, too. But, I mean, if you talk to, like, historians, like, Napoleon, like, regardless of his imperial tendencies, was an interesting person who, you know, say what you want about Mussolini, who made the trains run on time. I mean, that's a classic Archie Bunker line. But I mean, in Napoleon's case, he's like pushing for the metric system. And he was very much into like Enlightenment teachings about, you know, embracing science, but also learning the classics. And he was well regarded as like a military tactician and as a conqueror. Like there's meat there that can be explored. You don't have to like Napoleon, but I mean, there's a compelling story there.
Yeah, but I guess some of the trouble is, is he the hero or is he the villain of the story? Mm-hmm. Like, what, from whose eyes are you telling it? Because if he's the villain, then we're telling it from the eyes of, you know, the democracy of France.
Right.
And I don't know if you spend a lot of time in America. They're not really down with France. Like, they don't really, I feel like French culture, unless it's about eating baguettes and losing weight, North America doesn't care that much about France's culture. I mean, Marie Antoinette. I didn't even see it, to be fair.
I enjoyed
it. I don't know if it was a big hit.
I don't know if it was a big hit either, but I enjoyed it. It's certainly the way Sofia Coppola made that. It's basically like an 80s movie dressed up in the French garb. But
you know, here in North America, we sort of see France, the culture of France, as kind of snooty and snobby.
Yeah.
You know, we have a love affair with Italy and with Spain and maybe even with the south of France. But, you know, you don't see like travelogue movies about women finding themselves by going to France.
Interesting. Interesting.
So from whose eyes do we tell the story of Napoleon? I feel like then we're forced to tell it from his eyes.
I mean, that may not necessarily be a bad thing. I mean, just because someone's like the protagonist doesn't mean they're the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something like Downfall, which was about the last days of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any heroes there because you have this man who's like clearly losing his mind and was, you know, not the greatest guy in the world to begin with. And then you have all these sycophants who are there around him, like trying to mitigate him, trying to like just hold on until, you know, maybe they can surrender and maybe, you know, they get to weasel out of this catastrophe they created. I think you can make a Napoleon movie and not, like, necessarily make, like, an acceptance of who he was. But I think you can certainly still admire people who were conquerors.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least, you know, present them in such a way that you don't condone what they did, but you can certainly, you know, present them in a way that, like, this is a significant figure of history. And to go back to Bill and Ted.
Yes.
They play Napoleon as this, like,
Buffoon
who's, you know, he goes bowling and he gets the gutter ball and he starts pounding his fist on the wood, swearing yes. about missing. And it's like...
Ice cream all over his face.
I think when we think of Napoleon, that's not exactly how we think, but it's within that wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And I think... maybe we owe it to Napoleon yeah. to have a bit of a broader appreciation.
I think what we need to do is make, much like an Abe Lincoln versus zombies film, we need to make like Napoleon versus merfolk or I don't yes. know, some sort of water-based sirens. Napoleon versus the sirens.
Napoleon versus Aquaman. Yeah.
Well, you went a very different place than I was going. But
no,
you
not
know,
Aquaman,
whatever.
But like one of Aquaman's ancestors.
Okay.
Like, yeah, now we're on to something. Let's start writing the screenplay. We're going to take a break to start our pitch, and then we're going to come back and review Child's Play. And to cue that up, we're going to just listen to the Chucky Danger Band with a little standing ovation. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
A standing ovation brings finalization. Step aside from reality, the acid turns away to hide and seek. Clouds rolling on end, born a devious day. Almighty will steal.
Over here, Andy.
Leave me alone!
Over here. If they don't let us play, they all go away.
Why are you doing this?
Are we having fun now?
Are you my best buddy?
If they don't let us play...
And that was a clip from Child's Play. It is the new film from Lars Klevberg, and it stars Aubrey Plaza, Gabriel Bateman, Brian Tyree Henry, Tim Matheson, and Mark Hamill. And I kind of loved it.
Oh, I'm not that positive about it, but
oh, really?
But I'm, you know, I'm not going to sit here and trash it.
I dug it. I dug it a lot, actually.
That's exciting.
Yeah. I think it does what a good remake should do,
mm-hmm.
which is to like update the concept.
Yep.
And not have to rely on like the tropes and not have to rely on, you know, what came before. It feels newer.
Yep.
It feels
yep.
a bit more modern. Mm-hmm. I like the cast too.
Yeah, the cast was great. So how I feel about this is if you are Child's Play, like the original film and the Chucky series, if you are a fan of that,
mm-hmm.
you're probably not going to enjoy this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else, I think if you just want to watch a really decent horror film,
mm-hmm.
then this is a film for you. Like I think you're right in the way you described it, that it does what a good remake should do, which is just like don't make it for the old audience.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want it. Make
right.
it for a new audience. Bring forward the same sort of idea for a new audience and update it. And that is what they did.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I still think the original Child's Play film was great and better than this. And that's what I will... I am a Chucky fan.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy them.
Yeah.
But I'm also not the kind of person who's like, oh, I'm never going to see this movie. And Don Mancini doesn't want to have anything to do with it. And...
I you know what? I appreciate Don Mancini. He's like, I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want my name on it. I think a lot of, you know, filmmakers will like just let that happen because then they get the nice paycheck. And, you know, this isn't his Chucky. I get that. He's continuing on with his Chucky in other places.
Which is also great, by the way.
Right. And, you know, I appreciate that, you know, a lot of fans don't want a remake. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I like those Chucky movies too. I think there is a lot to recommend that first Chucky movie.
Yeah.
But you know, I can appreciate the same story told two different ways.
Yes.
And this is what I want from a remake. I don't want you to walk me through the script with new people, but the same old script. You know, I want you to try and, you know, give me a reason why you want to remake this other than we have this IP and we can do it.
Yeah.
You know, just doing it isn't a reason to do things. And this reminded me a lot of an episode of The X-Files, actually. Well, the new incarnation.
Oh, like, okay, because I haven't seen the season 11
yet. Right. But there's an episode during that season which is about automation and AI and tech and things.
Oh, no, I did see that one. Yeah. So are you sure that wasn't the season 10?
I think it was 11.
There's no dialogue at all in that episode, and it was great.
Yeah. But it's about Mulder and Scully basically being chased by drones and apps and things. And at the end, Mulder says, like, we have to be better teachers. And I feel like that's the moral of this film, is that we have to be better teachers because Chucky, granted, you see at the beginning factory workers screwing around with the Chucky programming.
Because you think it's that easy that the average guy can just like disengage all the security protocols.
He's just going to hack. it's implied that he's
out of nowhere.
Yeah, it was implied he was sort of like taken off the streets and he's like a typical sort of factory worker in Asia. But he can hack a sophisticated AI. But it's not just that. It's that, you know, Chucky learns certain behaviors.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a scene where Andy and the kids are watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Great choice.
Yeah, they did such a good job with that scene.
And well, you know, the kids are laughing at the gore and the violence. And Chucky's observing them like, okay, this is funny.
This is how we have fun.
Right. And, of course, you know, because he's an AI and a doll and things, he can't tell the difference. And I think that's a really compelling play. And also the way that Chucky isn't the soul of a serial killer inside a doll.
Yeah.
It's an AI. And because of that, his motivations are different. And another vibe I got from this is that there's kind of a fatal attraction thing.
Oh, yeah. I felt like I was watching Single White Female.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is exactly what happened. It's just like, no, you're for me and only for me and nobody else can be your best buddy.
Right. And if anyone threatens to get between us, they're done.
Yeah. It was, I mean, I do like the way they chose to update that. You know, in some ways, I was kind of like, I don't know. Like, so many of these films about technology don't do a great job of, like, it's laughable. But I think that they did a pretty good job in this case because they didn't really rely on the fact that it's the Internet of Things that much.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, make it like Kubrick/Spielberg's AI and make, it was just brought back enough that we can go, okay, this is one thing that's supposed to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was also so sort of lifelike, which I thought at first, I was like, I don't know. I think that this is not going to look very good.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually didn't look as bad as I thought it would.
No, what I like too is one of the things that irks me about those Child's Play movies, the early ones, is that when they need Chucky to move around and things, they obviously get a little person and put him in the overalls and the red wig. This they might have, I don't know,
animatronic doll.
It feels like grounded. It feels like I'm watching a doll the whole time. And I don't know if it was just me, but the doll has kind of a resemblance to Mark Hamill. I had a Mark Hamill vibe with some of his facial expressions.
It can't actually be the case because Mark Hamill was only cast five months ago, right? Like, he just went in to film The Voice.
Yeah.
But, and I wonder if that's just Mark Hamill's ability to match his words. Right, because that's the thing. He's done so much work in voice acting.
Yeah.
And he is very, very good at it. And it really is a thing, right? To match your words and your actions to what's actually happening on the screen so that it really does look like it.
Right.
He did such great job with the voice.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I strongly recommend that everybody, there is no post-credit scene. And I know there are lots of people who leave the theater. That's, you know, who needs to watch the credits. But I strongly urge you to actually stay, because after the first sort of song that starts the credit scene, then we get Mark Hamill's voice singing the Best Buddy song.
The Buddy song, yeah.
And it's really good. Really
yeah.
good.
It's a haunting way to leave things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, of course, of, you know, the way it ends, too, with the leaving the door open for a sequel. But yeah, Mark Hamill, I didn't doubt Mark Hamill, but I was afraid he was going to do like some kind of Joker
thing.
Yeah,
that it would just sound
voice,
like the Joker,
or, yeah.
right?
It sounds very much like Mark Hamill. And it's still like refreshingly different from like Brad Dourif. Like when, of mm-hmm. course, when Brad Dourif's talking as Chucky, he's like, yeah, I'm Chucky. What are you doing? And, but you know, it's a bit harder to feel comforted in the presence of Brad Dourif's voice. But yeah, with Mark Hamill, he's able to work very, very subtly mm-hmm. that, you know, Chucky can say things in his Chucky voice that can be haunting.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of still get the emotion. And like, there's a scene where, like, after Chucky does something bad, they put him in the closet.
Yeah.
And he starts, like, don't put me in the closet. And it's like, oh, like, don't put Chucky in the closet. He didn't mean it.
Yeah, there were a lot of times. And I think that this says a lot about Gabriel. I'm not sure how he
yeah.
pronounces his name.
Yeah, yeah.
Gabriel Bateman and his acting that I think was so good, because it is a really fine line. Because mm-hmm. there are a lot of parts where we talk about, like, this is a doll. He's a little creepy. Like, there's all sorts of weird things. Like, we've got this whole, like, you know, the valley mm-hmm. in the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the same time, we can start to care about this doll mm-hmm. in the same way that Andy cares about the doll, while also still being... So, you know, his acting created a
yeah.
little more humanity in this doll.
Yeah. And it's not like a thing like in the original film where Andy wants a good guy doll. It's this mm-hmm. thing that his mom, Karen, gives him, you know, because he's a kid and, you know, she works at, you know, like a dead-end retail
Z-Mart.
Job. Z-Mart.
Kind of like the S-Mart.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, I'm sure that was part of the yeah. Inspiration. But, they're kind of down on their luck, working class, single mom family, and he doesn't, like, he's not really interested in this mm-hmm. thing at first. And it becomes a friend for him, and it becomes a way for him to make friends, and, through their various adventures. And the film does a great job of, like, okay, maybe this will work out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a nice montage of them becoming friends.
Right. And then, but I think that one of the things this film does well is that it moves, it keeps moving.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very tight 90 minutes. Yeah.
I will say, however,
mm-hmm.
because I often talk about like 88 minutes is the perfect amount of time for a horror film. And I
yep.
will say that some, like very near to the end, I was like, this movie is about 6 minutes too long. However,
right.
I understand why, because there are two death scenes
mm-hmm.
that are somewhat relevant to the plot, but not entirely.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have taken either of those two out, though. But then, because those two are there, once we get to the Z-Mart and to the big scene, which is the same sort of thing, it's like, you can't really take that out because they've gone with a big climax.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm kind of there, and I was like, okay, I feel like we've already used up the extra time in which we would create some extra time for this climax.
Well, I think when we find out that there's, like, a new buddy doll coming and
mm-hmm.
there are multiple buddy dolls coming, I think we sort of see where the film is going to. And I don't think
yeah.
that helps.
Yeah.
The climax is fairly obvious.
Yes. And the bear buddy. Like, what's that going to do, I wonder?
Right. That's right. But, you know, I don't disagree. But... what I appreciate is that the filmmakers knew that they have a set amount of time that I think that
mm-hmm.
they know that they have you, that there's only so much ludicrousness you can kind
yeah.
of take. And they know that there's a set time they have to leave the stage and sort of let people leave the theater. And I think they use their time wisely.
Mm-hmm.
And going into those deaths, Those are some like elaborate and gory
yes.
death scenes.
It's almost like Saw level elaborate.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
You half expect to hear like Chucky, like live or die, make a choice. And of course, I mean, there is also a moral element to sort of these deaths, too, because
two of them definitely deserved,
right.
maybe deserved to die. Let me just not sound like a sociopath.
That's right. Right. It's interesting.
Two of them broke a moral code and therefore
yeah.
we're ripe for the picking
right.
of Dear Chucky.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot. I think there's a lot going on here. I think Lars Klevberg knows what he's doing. I think this is his kind of first big movie. I mean, he's got another one coming that was based on a short film he did called Polaroid, but I don't mm-hmm. think it's come out yet. But he's got talent. He's got talent. And I went into this super as cynical as anybody because...
Yeah.
I wasn't sure about Mark Hamill as Chucky. I wasn't sure about Aubrey Plaza as, like, the mom because I don't see Aubrey Plaza as the mom.
Yeah. But that they do a really good job of covering that right up front.
Yeah.
And she is clearly, like, you know, she's a young, what was her line? Yeah. Something about...
I had a really great Sweet 16.
Sweet 16 yeah. really paid off for me.
That's right.
Yeah. But, you know... Even in the choices she makes, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, yeah, this is a woman who, this is a teen mom. Like,
yeah.
And she is in all the places where you're going to end up when these sorts of things happen.
Yeah. But even just, like, the Aubrey Plaza-isms, like, when she, like, takes the doll and she, like, basically blackmails the store manager to take the doll. Mm-hmm. It was really great that they didn't try and Catherine Hicks her and... You know, by making the mom kind of blah.
But. And again, I mean, I've already mentioned Gabriel Bateman, but mm-hmm. I think he was a real standout mm-hmm. in this film.
Yep.
I really thought he was a very good actor. And I think that it was smart to have it a little bit older
mm-hmm.
Because let's be realistic, Andy in the first film is... You know.
Yeah, wandering around Chicago and nobody notices.
I know, for one thing. But also, you know, the actor does what he can,
right.
being like 6-year-old at the time.
Yeah.
But there is one other of the younger actors that I really want to mention, and that's her name is Beatrice Kitsos, and she plays a girl named Phelan.
Yeah.
And I loved, again, Aubrey Plaza when she gets introduced to his two new friends, to Andy's two new friends. Are those names?
Yeah.
And I didn't even understand what her name was until I read it. I was like, Phelan, okay.
And the other kid is Puck.
Yeah. Yeah. But she was great. And I loved that she was in charge the whole time. Like, she knew exactly what to do.
Right.
You know, and they didn't make it a thing, really.
Yeah.
It was just like, she was the only girl sort of in this group of
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the one who was like smart enough
mm-hmm.
and tough enough
mm-hmm.
to go, yeah, no, this we're doing this right now.
Yeah.
Also, I just love the fact that 12-year-old kids, just the trust that once you put something in the garbage chute,
yeah,
it just disappears.
Just disappears.
There's
just like that.
Nobody who does anything with that. It
yeah.
just magically goes away, the garbage.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Spoiler alert, that's not how garbage works. There are a lot of people involved. After you put your garbage into whatever receptacle you put your garbage into, many more people touch that garbage.
Yes. If there's a moral of this movie, that is it. And we'll have to leave it at the garbage. If you liked our show, and we hope you did, you can listen to us again and find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your podcast app on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify if you like. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Candace, where can people find you at various internet places?
At various internet places, I'm available at Cinn48, that's CINN48. I might be tweeting about the latest horror film that I've watched since I've been watching a lot of Shudder lately. So.
Oh, well, there you go. Stay tuned for that. And stay tuned for me on CIFRU. I'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz there. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or check out GuelphPolitico.ca. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will indeed be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.